Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and joining me for his third appearance on this bonus episode of the podcast, he's made pretty much all of my and your favorite comedies. Welcome back to the show, Judd Apatow.
Happy to be here.
It's good to have you back. How you doing? You look very nice.
I don't know. I think I look great, right? Don't I look good?
Happy birthday. We're talking just the day after your birthday.
That's right.
Did you celebrate with Adam Sandler on tour, or what's going on?
I'm on tour. I'm in San Antonio tonight doing a show, and then headed back. But I've been out for a week with him, which has been great. The crowds have been incredible. It's just so fun. You know, we've known each other for so long. So to see Adam perform in these big arenas and to do a little time before, it's a really magical, a full circle, a fun event.
Do you spend any time on stage with him? Do you guys collaborate at all during these shows?
There's a little thing that we do in the middle of the show that I don't know if described would really make much sense. But,
right, yeah, you have to be there.
You have to be there. Some things you just want to spare the audience the description of them.
So you've been here, as I said, two times before. We talked about the Gary Shandling documentary, which came in at just over 4 hours. And the George Carlin documentary, which came in just under 4 hours. Now we're here to talk about Bob and Donna Love Story, which is just 20 minutes. I mean, this is by far your shortest film, right? How did you restrain yourself?
I've changed. All my movies are going to be shorts now, no matter the genre. Well,
yeah, this changed you.
I got a call from Bob Newhart, and he said, I'd love to do something about my friend Don Rickles. I don't want people to forget about him. So maybe we could make something about our friendship and his work. And I had to say yes, because Bob Newhart and Don Rickles, I mean, they're some of the big reasons I went into comedy. Certainly when I was a kid, I would watch The Bob Newhart Show every day for years. When I look back, years of watching that show every single day. And I had met him a few times, and he's always very sweet. So I thought that would be a fun thing to do. So we started shooting. I didn't really know what would happen with it. I just shot it with my own money just to explore it. And then at some point when we started editing it together, me and my partner, Michael Bonfiglio, who directed it with me, we realized that there was something really sweet about it, that Bob is so kind, but he also misses his friend, and there's something heartbreaking and melancholy about it. And we just decided to just lean into the truth of what it was, which is, it's wonderful to have a friend for most of your life. It's very sad when they're not around. And this desire he has for people to remember Don. And, you know, we all do, because we're in comedy. So I think all comedy people every once in a while go to YouTube and go watch some Don Rickles clips. But it's nice to remind the world how riotously funny he was.
Hey, that's what I do, my friends. I laugh at people. I laugh at blacks, whites, purples. I laugh at all, my whole humor. I came this far in America. Why? Because I laugh at what the heck we are. That's what we have to laugh at. You're a black man, right? I took a guess.
Yeah, one of the big themes of the film is how they were such close friends, but their comedic styles were so different in a lot of ways. Do you see it that way? Or after sort of doing this, having this experience of really looking at their work, do you find that they had more in common than maybe people thought? Or were they really that different?
Well, on stage, you know, Bob Newhart was somebody who was very meticulous. He follows in the tradition of people like Bob and Ray. And, you know, his story is so interesting because he was an accountant and he wrote all these sketches. And he had a friend who worked at a radio station, and then they let him record the sketches, and he got a record deal out of it. And then he had to perform them in front of an audience, but he'd never performed in front of an audience before. And when he recorded the album, I think he'd only performed in front of an audience for a couple of months total.
That's so crazy.
And it became one of the highest selling records of all time. He beat Sinatra for best album of the year. I mean, his thing really exploded.
It's hard to imagine now.
But it was very written, where Don, as described by Bob, seems like someone who just has attention issues, jumps on stage. He has the things he does every night, but in terms of riffing and making fun of the crowd and insulting people, it's just pure in-the-moment madness. Bob said that if he thought of something really funny off the top of his head, he would never remember it, ever. And if you told him, oh, my God, that thing you said to that guy, he wouldn't write it down and remember it. That's not what it was to Bob. He had kind of a set act for most of his career and then sections where he would just play with the crowd. And whatever happened, happened. He was just in the moment, and that's the opposite of Bob. But in real life, I think Bob has a vicious sense of humor. He is funny and cutting, and he will insult you, and he loves to brag about how, you know, he was more successful than Don in television, and that's just the way that he has always had his relationship be with Don.
It's funny, yeah, they do roast each other a little bit, you know, both in their friendship, and we see a little bit of that, but Newhart's son speculates that they were able to be as close as they were because they weren't competing with each other, that they didn't feel like they were in competition. Did you get that feeling? Do you feel like that was true?
Yeah, it didn't feel like that way at all, even though they gave each other a hard time about it, because Bob would always say, you know, Don was in the small room downstairs, doing the lounge, yeah, yeah. And I was in the big room.
Don is my best friend, which just gives you some idea of the difficulty I have in making friends. But Don has not done that well in television. He's had 4 series now. The last one, a couple of Don's, received a -4 Nielsen rating. This means not with no one watching, but several people without TV sets had heard about the show and said if they got one, they wouldn't watch it.
So I think they insulted each other about it. But, you know, Bob worked really hard on all these sitcoms forever. And Don was a gigantic Vegas act who never could get a sitcom going. And so they both had their worlds where Don really was like the king of Vegas comedy and traveled the world. And Bob was like one of the greats of TV of all time. He had the Bob Newhart Show and Newhart. I mean, to have 2 shows which were gigantic for like 8-9 years each in a lifetime is pretty remarkable.
Do you remember the first time you met Don Rickles? Did you have an experience of getting sort of made fun of by him or anything like that?
Well, the first time I interacted with him, I was 11 years old, and I went to see him at the Westbury Music Fair, and there were 2 seats empty in the front row. And so me and my brother snuck down and sat there, and then he just ripped on us here and there throughout the show for having no parents. He just kept talking about the kids with no parents, you know, that we were neglected.
Were you happy about that, to be targeted by him?
Oh, yeah, that was great. And I went to see him a lot through my life and would go see his headline sets. Newhart, I had only seen do stand-up live. I did a benefit for 826 in L.A., which it provides, you know, free tutoring and literacy programs for kids. So we would do these weird variety shows. And one year, the lineup was Pee Wee Herman, Bob Newhart, Colin Quinn, Ray Romano, John Bryan, and RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan.
Perfect.
And Bob went up. You know, he's nervous before, as if he hasn't been doing it for 65 years, and then just tears the house down, as if he wrote the whole act. I mean, it all really held up, even the old routine. So I was glad I got to see him at the top of his game performing.
Did you feel growing up like you were more of a Newhart or a Rickles guy, or you were kind of happy in both camps?
I mean, I would love to be either of them because the raucousness of Rickles and the ability to just go off on people seems like the most fun ever if you can define your thing as allowing that, right? And Newhart as just the funniest creator of these one-man sketches. And really one of the most popular and most hilarious sitcom actors of all time. If you go back and watch those shows, him with those slow burns and his slow talking and his, you know, a pace that's all his own and his reactive comedy. But he also seemed pissed underneath it. Every once in a while, you could tell that most of it was about him being annoyed with everybody. So, you know, obviously, to have either of their careers would be a dream. I mean, I remember he went on one of the last Tonight shows, Don Rickles, and he was so rough on Carson. I remember there was a look in Carson's eyes like, this hurts. It wasn't, like, I love Don, because Don kept going, Johnny, good thing you quit while you're on top. And he'd roll his eyes, and he's like,
he hit a little too hard.
He's like, I'm gonna keep kissing Ed's ass because he's still got the Star Search show.
Yeah, I do wonder whether Rickles' style of roast comedy has kind of fallen out of fashion at all. It's something I was just talking about with Whitney Cummings, because she was kind of she's been trying to bring the roasts back on this new platform after it seems like Comedy Central maybe has decided they don't want to do them anymore, and been a while. Do you think that it's sort of people have less of an appetite for roasting than they used to?
It's always hard to know, because the people that don't like it, how big a majority of people are they? And so if there's a certain minority that's like, I'm offended by all of this, does it go away because of that? Do all the people who love that type of humor find a way to still enjoy it? Obviously, you know, we all love Jeff Ross's roasts and his work, and he kept that alive for a long time. And I think out there in the world, in the clubs, they still are doing a lot of roast battles, and it's still a vibrant thing. But, you know, it's taste. Like, for me as a kid, nothing was funnier. I couldn't have enjoyed it more. And it always felt like he's getting everybody. And as long as he gets everybody, it's okay. It's not like he's attacking this kind of person, but not that kind of person. But some people feel like it's all hurtful, don't do it. So it's hard to know what the world would make of him if he arrived on the scene right now.
Right, yeah. He kind of got out before he could be canceled or have to deal with any of this stuff that has become such a big talking point in comedy.
But every time I've been to roasts and watched roast battles, I was in Montreal when they did tapings there, the crowd couldn't love it more. So it's like a
license to say whatever you want, and sort of a safe space to use the word differently to go as hard as you want to go, and everyone kind of goes in accepting that those are the rules of the game.
Yes. So, you know, as an audience member personally, I enjoy it. I couldn't do it because I'm too thin skinned. I don't want to be near a place where people might roast me. I got asked to host one of those roasts on Comedy Central, and I said
no.
Oh,
really?
Because I said, I don't want to know what the joke is on me. As soon as
which
I find
one,
out,
which,
I'll be devastated.
Which person were you going to roast? Was that Franco?
Yes. And I did not want to know what cruel things could be said about me. I'm sure I'm an easy mark.
You enjoy watching, but you don't want to be the target. Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering for you if it's inspiring to make this movie and see, you know, people like Bob Newhart and, you know, Mel Brooks and until this past week, Norman Lear, you know, working, staying funny into their, 80s, 90s, in Norman Lear's case, up to 101. I mean, how have you been thinking about that generation, you know, especially this week with the loss of Norman?
Well, Norman was a good friend, and I used to visit him a lot. And earlier this year in January, I went over to his house and had an afternoon hangout with him, Dick Van Dyke, and Mel Brooks. And it was remarkable how sharp they all were, how funny, how delighted they were in being funny and making each other laugh. And, you know, they had stories about their time in World War II, and they talked about that for a long time and all their different experiences and all the different eras. And I think the key is they just love it. That part of them never disappears. And they were also people, and, you know, Dick and Mel still are, who are just up on everything. They're just very current and vital people. And Norman was to the very end. None of them, you know, checked out and went to an island and decided not to do more stuff. They go out, they do shows. I know they're about to shoot a tribute to Dick Van Dyke for one of the networks. I got to interview Mel Brooks for The Atlantic earlier this year about his reflections about life and the world. So that's something I look up to. People who can be great at their job well into their 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, when you see, you know, The Who and The Rolling Stones, and
yeah.
And you're like, how is this even possible? that they could still be this strong and put out a new record that's great. That to me is the goal.
Yeah, I mean the Rolling Stones thing and those guys, I mean what they're doing is kind of insane, but comedy at least does seem like the kind of thing that you can just keep doing for as long as you're alive, you could keep doing it.
Well, Norman always said, "I feel like I'm the age of the person I'm with." And I thought that was a really beautiful idea. You know,
he didn't see himself as 101, I'm sure.
No, not at all. And talk like someone who just enjoyed staying in it. He was still producing in the middle of tons of projects. The last 5 or 6 years, he got so many things made. All of those restagings of his television shows that he did with Jimmy Kimmel were all so funny. If your job is to make the world happy, why would you want to stop?
Were there specific, you know, Norman Lear shows or projects or things that you feel like really influenced your work or something things you thought about a lot while you were making films or anything else?
I was born in 67, so everything he did was my entire childhood. It just lined up exactly with my youth. So, you know, when I was 6 or 7 years old, I started watching All in the Family. And, you know, Norman Lear and Larry Gelbart and James Brooks, those are the people who made most of the work I was watching as a kid. And, you know, watching All in the Family every week, when you're little, when you're in elementary and middle school and high school, programs you for a certain type of morality and ethics, even though you're not watching it for that. And as a kid, you don't even know that's what the show is. You just think it's about a show with this cranky guy and his son-in-law, and they debate the issues. You're not intellectualizing it. You're not thinking this is medicine anyway. You just think this is hysterical. But later on in life, you pay attention to what it meant and what it told you and how it was really about, you know, compassion and growing and, you know, a way to look at how you should be as a person in the world with other people. And so I look at it like everything I do in some way has been influenced by that. I try to tell stories about people who screw up and learn lessons. And that's what I think comedy is. It's making terrible mistakes and hopefully coming out of it a slightly better person.
Yeah, it does seem like, you know, there was the what Gerard Carmichael was trying to do with his show, maybe as the last example. But I feel like now you don't see people disagreeing in a friendly way about political issues on TV in the same way, right?
It is rare. I think South Park probably has taken that mantle.
In a sort of different way, but yeah.
Yeah, in their way, where they can talk about anything and go really hard and get to a point. But yes, there's not a lot of that. I think that there's something about how entertainment works where people are afraid of that. They're afraid of political comedy. They're afraid of characters who maybe make mistakes that are that big. So it could happen again, though. You never know. Out of the blue, someone could crack a way to do it, and it could be a big hit. Obviously, someone should talk about polarization.
This is completely unrelated, but I just started rewatching Girls from the beginning. And, you know, I loved it when it was first on, but it's really blowing me away the second time. And really seeing it from a new perspective. And I realized that I think I was right around their age when I watched it the first time. And now I'm a lot closer to the age that you were when you were working on it with them. So I'm not even sure what my question is, but what was it like sort of being that age and working on that show? And how do you think about it now?
Well, I'm really glad that people are watching it now. I feel like it's maybe more popular now than it ever was, that people are watching it on Max. And you have young people discovering it, and you have older people watching it again. And I always thought that there was all sorts of things that people talked about around the show. But for me, I thought the show was really funny. And Lena and the cast were hilarious. So I feel like people are noticing that in their second watches.
Maybe like the original, it was all focused on the cringiness of it or something, and now people are sort of seeing how funny it was.
Yeah, and also, you know, what it was talking about at the time, Lena was very aware of, which was these entitled girls in New York who really thought the world was owed to them. Like, that was the joke. And then when it aired, there were definitely people or critics, I guess at some point, didn't understand that Lena had created the joke of the show. And so now that we look at what the culture is like, I feel like Lena was talking about all of this a really long time ago. And that's what she found funny, is that it wasn't like a Sex and the City version of New York, that it like kind of, for them, sucked. You know, like, yeah. Their jobs were terrible, and their relationships were scary and weird and creepy, and their friendships really aren't going well. And, you know, that show, if you look at it now, part of it is almost about the dissolution of a friend group.
That's
what, you know, Jenny Connor, who ran the show with Lena, they all found so fun was that by the end, most of them had really turned on each other. And we would sit around and just go, oh, my God, it's so funny that Shoshana hates them so much. And
well, that's what made it so much more realistic in some ways, right? It's like you don't stay best friends with your same four people for your entire 20s.
Yeah, and so it's so fun that people are watching it. I think that TV in some ways has gotten a little tamer and more concerned with offending people. And it might be one of the shows that was allowed to do a lot of stuff that you couldn't do now. And I think that's why people like watching it, because you don't feel like the show has the handcuffs on. And that's a fun part about it. And then you can get deeper into all these sociological issues.
A lot of people are like, you could never make friends now, but that's the wrong take. Maybe it's you could never make girls now.
Yeah, I mean, I wish you could, and I hope that I'll be proven wrong. But definitely Lena and Jenny got a lot of freedom to express themselves in a really wonderful way. The people that ran HBO loved the show and just encouraged them to take it really far and experiment. And I feel like the last season was really strong and it ended in a really cool way. So for me, it's all fond memories. But what's weird about streaming is to most people, it's brand new. You know, people watch it like it just was made yesterday. So I have to adjust my head for that. Like, oh, time is like stacking with streaming. You know, people watch Freaks and Geeks like it's new. They don't watch it like it, like I used to watch The Honeymooners.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a show they haven't seen yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they both hold up. So before we go, can you share any joke or anything that you're doing on stage right now that you're happy with, or that would been going well?
Oh, I've been listing on stage reasons to quit doing stand up.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just list all the reasons. You know, one is all my references are from the 1900s. That's how you know when you should stop. You know, you don't know who Doja Cat is. You become that guy, the guy that doesn't know what the kids are up to. And it makes you feel like, you know, like all your jokes suddenly become about decay. You know, when you get older, you're like, don't you hate it when you're always afraid of falling? Like, that's when you should stop doing stand-up, when most of your jokes are about ailments. Don't you hate diverticulitis? So I feel that call to stop. But I am very proud that we have a movie I produced out called Please Don't Destroy, The Legend of Foggy Mountain.
Yes, yes.
With the Please Don't Destroy boys from Saturday Night Live, which is on Peacock. And I'm really proud of that. It's hilarious. So if you don't have Peacock, you could sign up. I think it only costs $1. Peacock, right? It's like $1.
Yeah, or it's free if you have certain, I don't know, it's hard to know how all these things work, but
it's free if you just want a lot of ads. There is a way to see the movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's really funny. Conan O'Brien.
You got Conan really to act. That was that's a feat in itself, right?
That's right. And then we were like, how come he hasn't acted before? Because he's so good. What a waste of this talent.
Maybe this will be the start of a new career.
Yes, I hope.
Well, Judd, thank you so much, as always. And I really adored the short film. It's really wonderful, and I hope everyone gets a chance to see it.
All right, thank you.
Thanks again to Judd Apatow for coming back on this podcast for a third time. Please do take 20 minutes to check out Bob and Don, A Love Story, which is available to stream on the New Yorker's website, and we'll include a link to it in the description for this podcast as well. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads, at Matt Wilstein, and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.